It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls a bit later at 866-439-5277. You can always email me, talk@LarsLarson.com. Follow us on Twitter at Lars Larson Show and on Facebook at The Lars Larson Show. It is such a pleasure to have best-selling author William Forstchen on with us again, the man who has done so much to try to advance the cause through a little bit of fiction of getting America prepared for the kind of disaster that could hit us because of an EMP, either from natural causes like the sun or from forces antithetical to the United States, like, say, a North Korean nuke launched over the West Coast that could black us out in a way that would kill millions of people and really put our country in a tough spot. Mr. Forstchen, thank you very much. I'm glad to have you on to talk about your third book in the series, The Final Day.
Pleasure to be with you, even though we got to talk about some grim stuff today.
Well, let's talk about this, first of all, for people who are not familiar, because they haven't read One Second After. I was telling you, my adult children have read it, and I was a little surprised, pleasantly, that they were as interested in the subject. But they read One Second After, and then immediately went after One Year After, your second book in the series. Sketch out the story and what has happened to the characters in that story that could happen to all of us in real life.
Okay, we'll have to go back to 2004. I was in D.C. On the day that the congressional report on the effect of EMP was released. I urge all your listeners after the show, if they want to find out more, just Google up EMP congressional report. What that report stated was that the detonation of between 1 to 3 small nuclear weapon, about 250 miles above the United States, sets up electrostatic discharge, known as an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse, hits the Earth's surface, feeds through the wiring system of this entire United States, the tens of millions of miles of wires, overloads the power grid, blows it offline, literally in that first second. Recovery time could take years to bring it all back together again. Both congressional reports, the one in 04 and 08, stated, this is the hard number, 90% of all Americans would perish after such an event. People ask, well, why? It's not the bombs themselves. You might not even notice they were detonated. But when the power goes off, where do you get your water supply? Where do you get your food? Where do you get your transportation, command and control, medical, all of these issues? The fundamental building block of our incredible civilization is electricity. Pull that off, we're tossed back 1,000 years. And chaos and terrible death is the result in what would be the most devastating war in the history of humanity.
And all of this could happen not from nukes striking the surface in our country, but from being exploded way up in the atmosphere. And we've actually seen EMP effect before during nuclear testing, haven't we?
Yes. You know, Lawrence, how old are you?
I'll be 58 in a few months.
Okay, you and I grew up during the Cold War when the imagery of that was like from Dr. Strangelove or Failsafe of nuclear weapons detonating and destroying our cities. Well, back in the early 60s, just before the test ban treaty, both we and the Soviets actually tested popping a missile out of space. The American test was known as Starfish Fry, Soviet test 184. The results freaked everybody. The nuclear weapon is maybe not the most effective for destroying an enemy on the ground. You just pop it over his country, blow out his power grid, and it's gone. And then sit back and let them die. This is what could be called an asymmetrical first strike by, you know, military talk. It means in that first second, you take your opponent off the line and you die. We're going to be observing the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor tomorrow. We got caught by surprise. We lost 3,000 dead, but we came back. 44 months later, we were in Tokyo Harbor. Coming back from an EMP strike, there is no coming back. It's a game ender, literally in the first second.
Just so people didn't miss it, 90% of our population dies. And the chaos that's left in the wake of all of that, you have to remember that every one of our members of the military is also an American citizen, and those people are not unaffected by it. And just so people get the full import of this, before we go to talk about natural causes and other things, in 70 years ago at the time, 75 years ago at the time of Pearl Harbor that you just mentioned, We would have been a country where if you had the ability to, to launch an EMP attack on America, you would have turned out the lights and for some people, but not all people in those days, their refrigeration, but not much more. You would have shut down factories. But today, everything runs on chips. I mean, virtually every device, your toaster in some cases, has an electronic chip in it. And just so people understand, that EMP effect fries the chip and there is no coming back. The chip does not get better when you recycle and reboot. So it's not as though, like your power going out, when the power comes back, all the devices come back on. In this case, when the power comes back, almost none of the devices that run on any kind of chip, which, as I said, is almost every vehicle in America, and certainly almost every device in an American household or an American factory or an American office, is gone permanently, right?
You got it. Very quick example might be 75 years ago, it's a Saturday night game, people are taking a break, the toilets are flushing, people are cooking food. So down at the water plant, they get on the phone and call up old Charlie at the flood dam and say, hey, open up gate number 3. Well, today you just push a button and a little computer does it all. All of that is gone. And once it's gone, trying to get back online would be devastating.
And in those days, there might have also been that the farmer who had pressurized water in his house also knew that he had about in a back shed the old hand pump. So he could have gone back there and said, hey, Mama, I'm going to go out and fill up a couple of buckets. It looks like the water is out for a while. And he would have had water. But today, there is really no civilian equivalent for most people in America of a hand pump to access the well, even if their house happens to be on a well.
The whole system. We built a beautiful, complex, computer-controlled, labor-saving system. Its most vulnerable point, though, is electricity. 2,000 years ago, when we lived in Walled City, if you had one hole in the wall, you were in deep trouble. The hole in the wall today for America could be electricity taking it out either through an EMP strike or even from a major solar storm. In fact, it would be the same. Devastation.
I'm talking to William Forstchen, who's the author of all three books, One Second After, One Year After, and now The Final Day, the third in the series. Before we leave this all together, let's talk for a moment about the natural causes of EMP, which could happen tomorrow. I mean, even if we assume that North Korea would never launch a nuke, that the Russians would never do it, the Chinese would never do it, and Al-Qaeda or ISIS would never do it, there's still the possibility that the sun could do this to us.
Absolutely. And, your listeners are already saying, gosh, this is depressing. Well, look, we're going to have to make it worse. This sun is a massive thermonuclear reactor on a very regular basis. In fact, almost every day, it is popping off what are called CMEs, coronal mass ejections. About every 75 to 150 years, a large one hits Earth head-on. Actually, it hits the magnetosphere that protects the Earth. Intense enough, it shoves the magnetosphere aside. This is kind of a simplistic answer. And it does the same thing. You have a major electrostatic discharge cascades through the Earth's atmosphere, starts impacting the electrical grid. Folks want to find out more about it, look up what's called Carrington, Carrington. Carrington event. Happened in 1859, blew out the entire technology of that time, the telegraphy system. Happens today, impact globally would be devastating.
But there is a way to protect against all this, but this could happen almost immediately, and there are ways to harden up our grid. We're going to talk more about that in just a moment. I'm talking to William Forstchen, who is the author most recently of The Final Day. It's actually scheduled for release in January of next year, and I want people to think about this seriously and about the implications for this country. It could happen to us naturally. It could happen to us because of forces antithetical to the United States, terrorists, or other foreign nations. And we'll talk more about it with William Forstchen in just a moment. You can send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com, and you're listening to The Lars Larsen Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larsen Show. My guest is William Forstchen, the author previously of One Second After and One Year After, about the effects that an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse, either generated naturally by the sun, which does it on a semi-regular basis, 75 to 150 years apart, or could be generated by a nuclear attack from other countries. Not an attack where where bombs drop on the ground and blow up buildings, but an attack far up in the atmosphere that would cause the kind of pulse that would knock out virtually every circuit, every electrical grid in America. So we've scared people half to death, but let's talk about how we could harden things up against this, at least keep the electric power on, which means fresh water gets pumped, sewage gets pumped, and certain things stay on, including things that are necessary for refrigeration. How could we go about hardening up America's grid so that we diminish the possibility that this kind of devastating attack would, as you pointed out, kill 90% of the U.S. population as they die because of the lack of services? That congressional report has now been out there for a long time. How could we go about protecting the country against it and at relatively low cost?
That's the whole point of writing the book. Yeah, okay. Write a book. Of course, it's going to shake people up because it is based on fact. But what is more important to me is, what do we do? Let me just draw an analogy for a couple of seconds. Imagine if it's December 1st, 1941, the indications are strong, we're going to be at war with Japan, and one of the staff for the president says, you know, we got a little problem, sir. All our airplanes are manufactured in Japan. Do you think that might be an issue if they ever hit us?
Yeah.
We're in that boat today. Of our major transformer and transmission systems, only about 15% is manufactured inside the United States. Guess where the rest is manufactured?
Asia.
Yes, 15%. We have almost no stockpiling of major systems for replacement. Many of the larger ones have to be custom made a year or two in advance. I just came across an article recently that of our infrastructure of electricity, you look out the window of your office right now, I'm looking out the window of my home in North Carolina, average age is 40 years. We're running on a rather antiquated infrastructure. We need to do the following. Let's end gridlock in Congress. We definitely need what's called twice the SHIELD Act came up, which was to start hardening our infrastructure mandated by the federal government. It was blocked in the Senate. That has to change. We have to change our foreign policy. We have to convey far stronger messages to rogues like North Korea and Iran. Don't even think about it. We need to upgrade our ABM systems. Now, people are listening going, gosh, how much is this going to cost with a deficit of $20 trillion? ABM, yeah, it's going to be $50-75 billion to protect the United States completely. Infrastructure, $50 to $100 billion. But I would ask all of you who own homes, say in the $300,000 to $400,000 range, would you own the home and not have a $1,000 insurance policy on it? Would you sit there and say to yourself, well, gee, the chance of my house burning down is about 1 in 100. Nah, I'm not going to pay the insurance this year. Try and explain that to your mortgage holder.
Well, and let me ask you this. We don't talk about doing it all in 1 year. It could start to have a positive effect if we switch these out. And Mr. Forstchen, one of the things I do to try and translate things for my audience, I say every time you hear about the government spending $1 billion, think $3 from each man, woman, and child in America. So when you talk about $50 billion as the bottom end estimate, that's $150 for every man, woman, and child. So a family of four is going to have a $600 cost. But if the cost is spread out over, say, 10 years, it becomes $60 a year, or it becomes $5 a month. So, and I understand we're all asked to pay more money for, you know, schools, for fire, for police, and everything else. But $5 a month to make sure the water stays on, the toilet's still flush, your food stays cold, the medicine that keeps some of your family members alive is preserved and can be transported, and when you pick up the phone, you can call and get fire, police, or medical to your house in 5 minutes. Is that worth $5 a month for every, you know, every average family spread out over a 10-year period if we started doing it immediately?
I'm going to use that from now on. That's a very good example.
It makes it sound cheap, doesn't it?
No, but I've been reading where you folks out on the West Coast have increasing concern about earthquakes.
Yep.
I'm willing to bet your earthquake insurance has gone up in the last several years.
Yep.
Are you going to say, nah, I'm not going to worry about it. I'm going to just drop the earthquake insurance. You'd be crazy. Frankly, this country is somewhat crazy if it's not looking at the fundamentals of keeping our system alive and running in any kind of crisis.
Well,
it doesn't cost that much.
I'm talking to William Forstchen, who is the author most recently of The Final Day, which is coming out in January of 2017. He's already written One Second After and One Year After, which should be mandatory reading by Americans who care about staying alive should we be hit by this either natural or artificial attack of EMP. But let me ask you something else about this. You mentioned that our grid is 40 years old. So an awful lot of the $50 to $75 billion you're talking about is monies where a utility company says, we need to take this 65-year-old transformer, you know, that's gigantic. It has to be ordered a year or two ahead of time. That thing needs to be switched out. So somebody goes to his boss, the head of engineering for your local utility, and says, we need to think about swapping that one out before it just fails on us because it's critical. And the boss says, well, how much is a new one? He said, well, the new one is, you know, $3 million or $5 million or $10 million. But if we buy the one with EMP protection, it's an extra what? 2 or 3% or 4 or 5% to make that one harden. So we're not talking about necessarily 50 to 75 as an additional cost, but 50 to 75 worth of stuff that needs to be changed out at some point anyway, simply because the old stuff is getting old.
Exactly right. Okay, let me throw another example. We can both recall when airbags started to come in on autos.
Yep.
And some people go, oh my gosh, that's $500. You got to be kidding me. Now, as parents, can you imagine us going down to the car dealership today? We want to get a car as a present for our millennial kids. Skip the airbags. Can you just pull them out and save me the $500? It's for my kid, but I'm not worried. They would look at us like we're sick. We would be sick. That's what is happening at this very moment. We should be mandating, as citizens from the bottom up, from government from the top down, when you're replacing equipment, we want it upgraded and hardened to be able to survive a major EMP event. This is a life insurance policy. Get it done. Spread it out across 5 to 7 years. I'd like to see some of it front-loaded, at least on crucial infrastructure lines. But overall, we could build a defensive system for our power grid in relatively short order.
Well, let me ask you about another thing, and that has to do with backups. It could be that if it's an artificial attack, meaning somebody like North Korea decides to hit the West Coast, it may be that the East Coast is still in decent shape or hasn't had as much of an effect. We're going to continue this conversation with William Forstchen, who's the author of the brand new book coming out in January of 2017, The Final Day. He's already the author of One Second After and One Year After. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It is my great pleasure to have with me William Forstchen, who's written previously One Second After, and of course, One Year After, and now the last book in the three-book series, The Final Day. They are fictional books, but they tell the reality of what America and the rest of the world is up against, that if the world is hit by an EMP caused by the sun, and they do come along periodically, our country is hit by a nuclear-launched EMP from, and you can list off the countries that could do it, including North Korea and the Al-Qaeda ISIS group that could go after us. The kind of devastation it would bring to this country. You and I were talking about the ways that we could prepare for this. What is the best way, assuming the new Congress says, yep, we want to do this, we're going to tell the utility companies to start making these preps, putting the parts on order, what's the best way to get something in place quickly so that if that EMP hits in the summer 5 years from now, if we're that lucky, that we have some answer to it or some workaround for the short term before we get the full hardening of the whole country?
You're hitting three or four points. One, we do need the federal mandate immediately. I was just watching the news this morning where they're talking about gridlocking over some cabinet appointments. For heaven's sake, let's get out of gridlock. We need an American people rising up, mandating. We want action done on a number of things, infrastructure being one. Even that's going to take some time. Second, every citizen should be thinking about their families, themselves, their community. I urge everybody. I know the term prepper, some people don't quite like it.
I am one, and I fully embrace it, and I'm not a paranoid nut. And by the way, Mr. Forstchen, your books changed what I do, because while I do have a ham radio, while I do have a cell phone and battery chargers and solar battery chargers and devices that actually run on little sticks and twigs that I can burn to recharge things, I also assume I should have a set of tools, and I do, that could be used to keep my family around, even if I assume all my electronics have completely gone kaput because of just what you wrote about. So I'm there with you.
It doesn't take all that much. Every family should be looking at, folks listening right now going, gosh, I live in an apartment, my budget's tight, what do I do? Next time you go to the market, just pick up an extra half dozen cans of food or dried soup or whatever. Have a basic Coleman stove, a safe place to cook it with. Have a backup heat source, if possible. In short order, you'll have a month or two of reserve on hand for a couple hundred dollars. If we face a major crisis, remember what happened with Sandy, where in Katrina, where social order really began to break down. Do you really want to be out in the streets at a supermarket with 500 people lined up trying to grab a loaf of bread and a bottle of milk? Or would you prefer to be safely home? Have a family plan. Know where your kids are. Know who's going to help out with grandma. Extend that out. Network with neighbors. Who has resources or skills? Make good friends with an EMT or a doctor that you have connections to enhance your survival while the government is working to try to bring things back up.
And don't forget your P-38. You remember the P-38, William?
Yes.
The little can opener that looks like a nothing piece of metal. I've ordered a couple. I have a couple of dozen of them, and they're scattered around in go bags because I assume, wouldn't it be horrible to end up, you know, with all those cans of food and nothing to open them up with?
Oh, you flash me back to a time I was out on the Gobi Desert. I found a pack of cigarettes. My friends refused to give me a match. I can't even begin to say what I was screaming at, but the same thing. Imagine you have a can and you don't have a way to open it. These are some very, very basic things people need to think about.
Now, I know Mr. Forstchen. By the way, I'm talking to William Forstchen. His latest book coming out in January of 2017 is The Final Day, the third in a three-part series about EMP and what it could do to our country. But let me ask you something. We always look to the government as the solution. You've suggested there's personal responsibility, and I agree with that. How about the middle of that? Is there a single utility company in America that has taken it upon itself to go to its ratepayers and go to the Public Utility Commission and say, we need to have a hardened grid here, even if the rest of the country is not paying attention to this problem? And so we'd like to, it's going to cost this much, it'll add, you know, 15 cents to your electric bill a day, you know, to make that $5 a month. But we're going to do it here, even if nobody else is doing it there. And we're going to, you know, consult with the local hospitals, fire station, police station to make sure that their stuff is hard enough. Is anybody in the middle, between the government and the people, taking steps on their own to say, we need to be ready for this and doing the things necessary to make it happen?
I only know of one so far, state of Maine, a couple of years back, the state government mandated upgrades and changes.
Bravo.
I've been down in North Carolina, I've been down to my state capitol twice to testify on this issue. Both times, the room was packed with lobbyists from the power company eager to dismiss the issue.
Why? Ordinarily, if you tell them, if you told your power companies, you have to do this, but you can pass along the cost of doing it to your customers. If it's no skin off that, you know, if they don't have any skin in the game and they can just simply pass along the costs, then what's the problem?
You hit the point precisely. I don't understand it either. I remember snapping at one of the lobbyists. I can't repeat my entire vocabulary with that. What about your family? What about your kids? Are you going to be taken care of while the rest of us aren't? Can't you people think ahead just a little bit? Various industries have taken government mandates. For example, airbags, upgrades in safety in automobiles and such. It really took the government listening to the people to finally get it done. We the people, those of you out there, you're in Oregon, you're a good progressive state. You should be pushing your state legislators to mandate that the government come down hard on the power companies. We want this job done. I think state-level action would actually be the most effective for a quick turnaround on this.
Now, let's assume that some device or some of the grid or some of the systems, cell phone systems, things like that, will either be repaired or will be hardened at some point. Is there any way personally to protect some of your electronic devices so you might have still some of them? And I would ask in particular, I've heard one suggestion, and that is buy an old junked microwave oven and take a few of your most precious devices, put them inside of that, and then stick it in the basement somewhere, that might provide the kind of protection that would do it. Is that the case?
Yeah, another thing for your listeners to look up, just Faraday, F-A-R-A-D-A-Y, Faraday cage. Microwaves serve that quite well. There's a lot of good websites with technical information on Faraday cages. That will protect your key electronic components. My wife and I, we have various electronics, including some walkie-talkies.
Which are cheap these days.
Yeah. Yeah, we threw them into the Faraday cage that I can connect with my in-laws who live about 4 or 5 miles away.
That at least gives you some kind of, and who knows, maybe all these private efforts by private citizens could end up, you know, replacing the communications grid to some extent, even if the public agencies aren't doing it.
Private industry has really jumped into this issue over the last 5 to 7 years. There are innumerable workshops out there. Again, those who are not familiar with preppers, ignore that stupid television show. Preppers are neighbors like you and me. Go to some of their training conferences, go to their workshops, go to their events, you know, trade fairs and everything else. There's a lot of stuff out there now focusing on the issue of EMP and how to survive.
Well, that's what you have to do. I mean, my family has done it, and I don't think we're not sensible. I think we're actually paying attention. And I assume that whether it's a storm that puts the power out for a couple of days or an EMP that puts the power out effectively forever, that people should be prepared for it. And one of the first ways to prepare would be to go back and read the whole series, 1 second after, 1 year after, and then the book, The Final Day, that you finished and is coming out in January. It is such a pleasure to have you on the program, and I'm so glad that you remember to mention, you know, Pearl Harbor and the anniversary, the 75th anniversary, which, as you and I are talking, is tomorrow, and the kind of thing that can happen to a country when people let down their guard.
Absolutely. It's a day of solemn recollection tomorrow, thanking the precious few vets we still have, and then taking a resolve that we're never going to let this happen to us again.
Mr. Forsen, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program. You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a great pleasure to be here. And sitting in front of me is General James Conway. General, it's a pleasure to have you stop by.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you.
Now, you talk about energy issues, but in this case, you'd like to be able to get people to have a little better access to their own paychecks instead of sending them off to Uncle Sam.
Yeah, we think it's all tied together, Lars. You know, this outfit that I am associated with called Securing America's Future Energy has taken an approach that says we need to reduce our import requirements of petroleum as a byproduct of our national security. That, you know, unfortunately, we're the most powerful country in the world, both militarily and economically, and yet, you know, we're hard-pressed to influence the oil market, the global oil market that is in no way a free market. And unfortunately, again, our individual citizens sometimes have to pay that price. We've had two instances where we've had some fairly significant tax cuts only to be followed, I mean, that very next year with a rise in oil prices that cost the individual family as much or more than they were saving in taxes. Now, with what we've heard and with the passage of the tax bill, there's income that's going to be put in the hands of our fellow Americans, and we just want to see them retain that. And so we really think that what we're doing is going to eventually loosen the stranglehold that some of the OPEC nations have on our great country.
Well, and how do we do that? Yeah. If we said, I mean, yeah, if I owned a forest, mm-hmm, and full of wood, yeah, and I used wood to heat my house, sure, and you came to me trying to sell me a cord of wood, yeah, I would think I'd be in a sweet spot and say, well, you. I'm sorry, Jim, but yeah, I'm not going to buy that cord of wood unless you make, yeah, me a darn good deal on it.
I hear you. I hear you.
Does that work as a metaphor?
Well, it does. And to answer your baseline question, this organization that I represent prospers three concepts. One is that we continue to produce as much petroleum in our country as we can. And we're delighted to see what private enterprise has done over the last half dozen years or so. Secondly, we think that we need to be more efficient with the oil products that we do use. Now, we're not necessarily trying to sell you a Prius today, okay? I've got a pickup truck and two SUVs, and my lifestyle's not going to change. But there are ways to be more efficient, notwithstanding the lifestyle that most Americans very much enjoy. The third thing, and it's tied to number two, is that we think we need alternative fuel sources to power our transportation industry. The vulnerability that I spoke to is because 92% of our transportation sector uses petroleum products as its primary source.
Yep.
I mean, that's huge. And you put together those statistics, 92% usage and 30% import, you know, from unstable nations, in many cases, there's a vulnerability there that I think we need to address and keep constant in the minds of our people.
Well, General Conway, how do we go about doing that? And can we make sure? I'm all in favor of alternatives,
yes,
as long as they pencil.
Yeah.
I don't want the Air Force buying biofuel or bio-kerosene to fly its jets, biojet fuel, at $40 a gallon.
Yeah.
So can we make both of those things happen?
Well, we think we can, you know. It's going to require innovation and American ingenuity and all those types of things, but we see it already happening. If you look at what's happening with electric vehicles, with autonomous vehicles, which are going to be important to my baby boomer generation, and those manner of things, there's some tremendous savings there, some tremendous efficiencies that will allow us to diversify what we need. And in the end, it's going to be good for the environment. It's going to be good for, again, the individual pocketbooks. And it's going to achieve what we want to see, which is less reliance on some pretty unstable characters for this global oil market.
General, I'm in favor of all that. What change is your organization proposing to make that happen? Or will the marketplace get there on its own? Because, look, if people say mileage only became important you know, in the last 10 years, I remember in the 1970s when I was a kid, and they tried to sell cars saying, our car gets better mileage. The car industry is trying to get there.
You lead into a great example that our whole country is going to see come to pass before our very eyes in the next 6 or 8 weeks. The EPA is right now about to put out a document that will restate, to use that term, what the Obama administration did in the last year of its time. The Obama administration established just kind of a throw against the wall stick there mileage requirement that was on industry that I think people are becoming are able to realize now is not quite realistic.
Right.
So the EPA is going to come out with something that says, okay, this is the adjusted standard, whatever that is. It'll be less than 55 miles per gallon. California and probably 12 other states are going to say, well, you know, we kind of like where we were. So how do you avoid that impasse? How do you keep it out of the courts? Our answer is, and it gets back to what we've talked about some already, is let's extend it past 2025, which was the Obama mandate, to about 2030, 2035, lessen the requirement in the near term and allow American auto industry to be innovative and come up with ways to get there. We'll get there, but let's do it sort of on their timeline based upon the savings that they can create, the additional types of vehicles they can try to sell us that will help, you know, reduce the fleet miles per gallon. So we're supportive of that. SAFE is kind of in between the government, the states, and the auto industry trying to say, hey, guys, there's a win-win solution out there for everybody. Let's all talk, and let's not get this thing settled in the courts. It's just not necessary.
Because, General, one of the things I've noticed is when you tell the auto industry the SUV I drive, it has to get this kind of mileage. They say, well, we can do that. We'll just make the SUV half as big. But that doesn't necessarily meet the needs. Whereas if you say, we'd like you to come up with an innovation that makes that engine work better, my Ford EcoBoost engine works great. It gets great mileage compared to a lot of SUVs even 10 or 15 years ago. That didn't come about through a government mandate. It came about because you said, hey, we want to make better engines.
Well, and price is a factor.
Right.
The automobile industry would tell you, we can do that, but it's going to make that thing cost $3,000 to $5,000 more. So, again, that's money out of our fellow citizens' pockets. But given time, we think that there's some things that they can do there. You also sort of addressed, Lars, what is the wild card in this whole discussion, and that is, you know, the industry will build what sells, okay? When gas prices are low, then, you know, they've sold a lot of SUVs over the last few years and not so many electrical vehicles.
General, it's a thank you for your
nice
service
you,
in uniform.
Okay.
You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you, and an especial pleasure to welcome back to the program, after too long an absence, Daniel Hannan, who's a member of the European Parliament. He represents southeastern England for the Conservative Party. He is the author, some time ago, of a book you really should pick up and read called The New Road to Serfdom, and of course, most recently, of How We Invented Freedom. It's a pleasure to have you on, sir.
It's great to be back with you, Lars.
Now, as a member of the European Parliament, should I refer to you as an MP there, the way I would if you were a member of the Parliament of Great Britain?
Daniel is great. I've given up trying to convince Americans that you are much more formal than we are, but it's true.
I want to talk to you about what is going on right as we speak. The vote will begin very soon to decide. Some of the votes have already been cast, of course, as early votes or vote by mail to decide whether or not Scotland becomes an independent country. You tell me, how do you think the vote will come out?
It's impossible to say. It really is. The polls are so close. If I were to tell you now what I thought was going to happen, I'd be either deceiving myself or deceiving your listeners, and I'd run the risk of looking a total idiot. Anybody who tells you that they know how it's going to go is lying. The momentum is with the pro-independence people, but the anti-independence people are so far keeping a tiny lead in the polls. It could go either way.
So the more important question, and that is, should Scotland become an independent country? And do you think you can speak to both points of view, the point of view of Great Britain, the point of view of the Scots, who I've heard say, what would the one gentleman say? We don't want a bunch of fops from Tottenham telling us what to do, I think was the phrase I heard.
Couldn't have been from Tottenham. You find very few toffs there. You find quite a lot of rioters and thugs there, maybe. But no offense to anyone listening from Tottenham. But there's no great obvious national difference, right? The border between England and Scotland is not linguistic or ethnographic. It came about through happenstance. So this is not like, say, the Quebec referendum. We speak the same language. We watch the same TV channels. We shop at the same stores. We sing the same songs. We follow the same sports. We dress the same way. We abuse alcohol the same way. We have the same obesity and teenage pregnancy issues. You know, there is a tremendous cultural unity, which you wouldn't normally justify a breakaway. So what's causing this? Why is roughly half the country demanding a change? Well, what they're arguing is that they will vote for more left-wing parties. They are fed up with getting conservative governments, which are elected with a majority of the English vote, when they are voting for socialist candidates in Scotland. And that really is the context in which we have to see the argument. It's not that Scotland couldn't survive as an independent country. Of course it can. It's just famously enterprising people. But I would worry about Scotland thriving under a government which had taken it to independence purely on the premise of spending and taxing more, which is what the argument of Salmond is. And that's really what it's going to come down to. But you know what? I'll tell you one thing, Lars. I'm really happy that I live in a country where these things can happen by referendum, where nobody seriously questions that a referendum is legitimate, and where we all abide by the outcome. I think that is a really healthy thing. And whichever way it goes, if Scotland, I would be a no voter if I were in Scotland. I have a lot of family there who are all voting no. But whichever way it goes, you know, I would rather, if the majority of people in Scotland really don't want to be part of the UK, I'd much rather be in a place that respects people's verdict than in one where people are held against their will.
From a distance, I think a lot of Americans can say we'd love the idea of independence, until I talk to people in the last few days from there who say, well, the Scots love their welfare. And unfortunately, they may follow that route that Prime Minister Thatcher said, socialism's great till you run out of other people's money. As you've suggested, if they're effectively voting for more welfare, that's a pretty short road till you run out of other people's money, especially when you've made yourself independent, so you can no longer depend on the rest of Great Britain to supply that money.
Absolutely true. But at the end of that road, in the long run, might come a corrective, because once you become independent, and once you have to raise your own taxes, once you have a proper link between taxation and representation and expenditure, you can't carry on just spending other people's money, and you have to start changing your policies so as to live within your means. So actually, oddly enough, in the long run, a separation, or at least fiscal autonomy, which I think is going to come either way now, I think it's going to happen whatever the result of tomorrow's vote, may create, for the first time in half a century, circumstances where a right-of-center political party can thrive north of the border, which is not something that you're ever going to have as long as Scotland is spending money that is raised largely through taxation elsewhere. But to repeat, you know, it's actually prohibited in the Constitution of the US for people in Oregon or Washington State to vote and secede. And I'm very glad that we live in a country where these things can be decided democratically. If my fellow citizens in Scotland really don't feel any connection anymore, you know, I'd be very upset. I'm horrified at the thought of calling my first cousins their foreigners. But I would rather live in a country where these things happen democratically than in most places in the world where you would have, you know, security services sent in to prevent it happening.
I agree with you on that. I would like people to be able to govern themselves. And I don't want to, you know, treat people in a way that diminishes their status. But to say, do you realize when you want to pay your own bills and you're thinking to vote for more welfare, you're going to be paying for it out of your pocket instead of somebody else's pocket?
Right. And actually, you know, now is an odd time even to be having that debate, because globally, globally, we're not doing so badly in the UK. You know, we have created more jobs, more net jobs in the past 4 years than all the other 27 members of the European Union put together. You know, of the G7 economies, the UK is the fastest growing. And that prosperity is affecting Scotland just as much as it's affecting England, Wales and Northern Ireland. I mean, you go there and you can't miss it. So, you know, what is the huge problem? Why choose this moment to walk away? I mean, part of I think the narrowing of the polls recently is just the negative and pessimistic tone that the No campaign has taken, I think very foolishly. Instead of saying, hey, you know what, things are not going so badly, why risk it? They couldn't bring themselves to do that because the No campaign in Scotland is dominated by the Labour Party, and they just couldn't bring themselves to say anything nice about the current UK government.
You're hearing the voice of Daniel Hannan, who's an author, a journalist, and of course a British politician, a member of the European Parliament, and the author most recently of How We Invented Freedom. Doesn't it present an almost impossible situation with regard to the nuclear weapons that have helped to safeguard both Great Britain and to some extent the United States as well, in that nuclear submarines will no longer be welcome at the only port where there's a port for nuclear submarines now, which is in Scotland? They'll have to be moved out of the country, not just because Great Britain will no longer leave them in what would be a foreign country, but because apparently the Scots don't want them there either. Can you speak to that, please?
Yeah, I mean, that's a concern that one hears a lot from British and other allied NATO generals. It's not going to happen overnight, and you know, I'm sure there would be some way of working it out. I think there is no question that the Western world would be politically and militarily debilitated a little bit by this, which is why U.S. politicians from across the spectrum have joined the campaign in urging people to vote for a continuation of the U.K. Having said that, though, you know, the case for more autonomy, the case for more devolution of power, I think is unarguable. And it's now clear that the day after a no vote, if Scotland does vote to stay in the UK, the government will come forward with a new package of further measures to be decentralised, and that has got to be a good thing. But in order to have that bit, you know, in order to have more autonomy, more self-government, you don't need to get rid of the United Kingdom, the country that ended slavery, that got the Industrial Revolution started, that defeated Napoleon and the Kaiser and Hitler, that played a brave part in winning the Cold War. You know, there's an awful lot that we should think about before we tear it up.
Daniel Hannan is with me. He's the author of How We Invented Freedom. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. Daniel Hannan is with me, the author most recently of How We Invented Freedom, and of course the author previously of The New Road to Serfdom. You mentioned in talking about Scotland and the vote that's going on right now that Great Britain's been doing pretty well. England's been doing pretty well. And I don't want you to be shy about this. I know you're fond of America, but England has embraced austerity a bit more than the United States has under President Obama.
Well, yes, I mean, that's setting the bar pretty low, to be honest with you. We've embraced it a bit more than President Obama has. I mean, actually, what we've shown, which I think is really interesting, is how it is feasible to reduce entitlements and maintain public support. It can be done if you do it in the right way. And you can save a lot of money over time simply by freezing benefits, not by not raising them anymore. You know, encouraging the growth of the private sector while leaving the state bit where it is, so that it is like a jungle swallowing up the old ruins in, you know, the old ruined temple somewhere. And that's basically what's been happening. We've got tumbling unemployment. We've got strong growth, not because there has been huge austerity, but because we've slightly tweaked the incentives to encourage people to go out and get private sector jobs. So, for example, you now don't pay any tax, any income tax, on the first £10,000 you earn, which is what now is $16,000, yeah. Something like that. I've noticed the change. I go around my constituency. Jobs that 5 years ago were only done by migrant workers, it now pays, you know, maybe a single mother to do a part-time job as a receptionist, a waitress, whatever, because she's now keeping the money. And that combination of the carrot and the stick of freezing welfare entitlements, or capping them, and at the same time giving people a tax incentive to take lower paid part-time jobs has made a huge difference. And you can do it as a right of center party and retain your opinion poll rating.
Daniel, do you find, though, in the numbers, and numbers only say so much, but do you find in the numbers that woman or that man who takes the part-time job and is making less than $10,000, when the point comes where her employer says, gosh, I could use you full-time, but I'm going to bump your paycheck up from, you know, 10 to 15 or 20, 20,000 pounds, that at that point, that person does make that leap and says, all right, I'm going to leave welfare behind and I'll become self-sufficient. Is that kind of transition happening?
Of course, it happens sometimes. And there's also the benefit that, you know, the children of this man or woman are growing up in a household where it's normal to work, which was not the case, I'm afraid to say, under the previous Labour government. We had lots of workless households, and we had parts of the country where work was a lifestyle choice. It wasn't a normal obligation. And that really has been, I mean, the fall in unemployment rates since this government took over has been almost miraculous. It's been the fastest drop in unemployment we've ever had. There are now more people working in the UK than ever before in our history. And, it's one of those really gratifying things, Lars, when you're in politics and you see a theory working exactly the way it's supposed to. You know, you tweak the incentives a little bit, you reduce the welfare payments a little bit, you increase the tax incentives, and people respond. It's not so much that this is saving us money. I mean, it's saving us a little bit of money. We're paying a little bit less out in our... But think of how that impact is being felt in people's lives, in people's communities. That, you know, I think it was actually even JFK who said the best social program is a secure job. I mean, you know, the route out of poverty in every country has got to be through work.
Let me ask you how you get to that politically, because you're a politician. But in America, if there's even a talk of, say, stopping the annual consumer price index increase of, say, Social Security checks or other checks, there's a hue and cry. Oh, you can't take away that 1.5% or 2% from us. And the politicians seem to be very gun shy of even approaching that or saying, let's freeze welfare and unemployment benefits and other social benefits. How do you get to that politically?
Right. And in a way, this is why I bring it up, because that's exactly what people said on this side of the Atlantic as well. Oh, you can't touch it. You know, people are very change averse. You know, it's much harder to take a benefit away from somebody than not to give them one. What we've shown is that you can achieve a huge amount, not by taking anything away, but just by freezing it.
You know, there's a lot of talk in the United States about setting a minimum wage. Let's see, if I do the calculation right, what would it be? It would be £25 an hour as the minimum wage, or 27. No, it'd be the other way around, wouldn't it? It'd be £10 an hour as the minimum wage for minimum skills. And we've had a great battle over it. Seattle is a major city, has decided to mandate it on private companies. Tell me what you make of that.
Well, we do have a minimum wage. And, I mean, of course, on one level, all minimum wages are they benefit the low paid at the expense of the unemployed. Basically, that however you tweak it and whatever the level is at, that's always going to be the effect at the end of the day. But that said, despite the minimum wage, we've had, as I say, this amazing jobs boom because other factors have been more important than minimum wage payments. And you know, the reason I'm talking particularly about this is I know American friends always say, you know, third rail of politics, you can't touch it. People are innately conservative. I think we have shown that in a mature democracy, with all of those factors and with a, frankly, a more welfarist, more entitled mentality than I've ever found in the U.S., even in Seattle, you can still do these things. If you do it in the right way, if you do it positively, and if you show that you're looking at rewarding people for doing the right thing, you're looking at helping people who have found work, you're not doing this to save money, you're doing it to save lives. If you make that argument in the correct way, it becomes, far from being an electoral liability, it becomes an electoral plus for you.
Well, and that's the concern I have. When you were talking about incentives, I thought when I made the minimum wage, and I made the minimum wage for a long time before I ever made better money, the minimum wage was a way of telling me every paycheck, you need more skills, buddy, because if you don't get more skills, this is not going to do it for you. And if you take that away by saying, we'll pay you $15 an hour, $30,000 a year. A couple making that would make $60,000 a year for minimum skills. And at that point, you've kind of taken away the incentive for the man or woman to go home at night and crack the books or go to a college or take courses or learn how to do better, because you've made them comfortable at a minimum wage, which is government taking incentives away to better your skills.
Right. I mean, the level of the minimum wage in the UK is considerably below that. But, you know, wherever you set it, and ours, as I say, is fairly low, so it's not having a massive impact. Mm-hmm. Wherever you set it, it is always going to have some impact. I mean, if you go to a country where there is no minimum wage, you find that there are people doing jobs that are just not done by anyone in countries where. So, you know, the guy to take your trolley back in the supermarket car park, or the porter in the railway station, or whatever. You know, these are jobs that you only get in a place where there isn't any minimum wage. So, even if it's a very low level, it's still resulting in some more unemployment than you'd otherwise have. And that's the trade-off you make.
Daniel Hannan is the author of How We Invented Freedom. He is a member of the European Parliament. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It is a great pleasure to have back on the program after too long an absence, Daniel Hannan. He's written The New Road to Serfdom, but more recently he's written How We Invented Freedom. But I should explain something, and I want to ask you about this. In Great Britain, it's How We Invented Freedom. But in the United States, I think your publisher played a dirty trick on you. They renamed it Inventing Freedom, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World, which I'm sure that some of our friends on the left will look at and say, well, how arrogant to suggest that it's only the English, how ethnocentric, you know. And I want you to talk. I don't feel that way, but I know there are people out there saying, well, hold on, you English-speaking people did not invent the modern world. Make the case, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, with pleasure. I mean, actually, if anything, it was my UK publisher who played a trick on me by changing my original title, which was the one that I use in your site. And I'm allowed to say that because he's coincidentally an old friend of mine.
Oh, so they wouldn't let you use the title?
They said, hang on, but, you know, well, let's say how we invented it, because, you know, we'll make it more patriotic for a British audience. I said, yeah, fine, whatever. You know, selling books is your business. But what you just said, Lars, is the natural reaction of somebody who hasn't read it and doesn't want to be familiar with the theory. There's a sort of reflexive cry of racism that goes up whenever you say anything nice about Anglo-American values or civilization. But the great thing about our system, and by our system I mean constitutional liberty, the common law values that elevate the individual above the state, is that those values will take root anywhere. They are not transmitted genetically. Okay, the Anglosphere is why Singapore is not Indonesia. It's why Bermuda is not Haiti. It's why Hong Kong is not China. If you get the structures right, it will take root in any territory on the planet, and it will lift that territory to a level of security and prosperity that is unequaled anywhere else by the human race. And so this is not something that you have to be born into. You know, it's something that you adopt by picking up the right creeds, the right values, the right way of thinking. And we should not be afraid of saying that. If we are shy or embarrassed about promoting our way of life, we actually make it much harder for people who have come and settled in our countries to feel proud about it. And we shouldn't then be surprised when some of them grope around for alternative identities.
But you see, there is such a pushback from that. I mean, this comes with the people who say, well, you know, there's really not a big difference between Christianity and Islam. They're both religions of peace. We've heard that from David Cameron. We've heard it from President Obama. We've heard it from our fine Secretary of State, John Kerry, who say, oh, it's just a different religion. But there is a difference between the cultures behind those religions, behind those languages, isn't there?
You could certainly argue that what I'm calling for shorthand Anglosphere values, in other words, constitutional freedom, liberty under the law, had a religious base. I think as a matter of historical fact, it was tied up with particularly the Protestant Reformation and the idea that all individuals are peculiarly accountable for themselves without any intermediary. But we've also shown that they can take root anywhere, that these values will work equally well in Ireland or in Hong Kong, that they're no longer, whatever their origins were, they're no longer tied to any confessional base. And I certainly don't think that Islam is intrinsically incompatible with Anglo-Saxon capitalism, as our enemies used to call it, Islam was the only great religion founded by a businessman. It doesn't contain any of the elevation of the poor that we have in Christianity and in Judaism. It's a very results-focused, and it's, again, very individualist. It has no hierarchy. So I don't think there's any theological issue that would prevent a Muslim country becoming a successful Anglosphere state, as long as you get the legal institutions there, the political institutions, property rights, free contract, independent judges, and personal liberty.
Do you think those roots could, those values could take root in places like Baghdad and Tehran?
Not overnight, because what you can't do is start with democracy. If you try and introduce democracy when you don't have the rule of law, it descends into mob rule. You need to have the rule of law first, as happened in Hong Kong, and actually then the democracy becomes much less vital. It's a bonus rather than the main cake. The big gain is the idea that the people interpreting the law are different from the people who write it. I do think you can have that. I mean, in the two great wars of the last 100 years, or the two and a half great wars, let's say, the First and Second World Wars and the Cold War, when the English-speaking peoples fought for freedom against tyranny, there were, in the First World War, 400,000, in the Second World War, more than 1 million Muslims who gladly took up arms because they recognized that those values were better than the authoritarianism that the other side represented. So, yes, I think it could happen.
So how do we get that to happen when you see a vote in Egypt that votes in the Muslim Brotherhood? They didn't last long, but the Muslim Brotherhood was the government. When you see votes that put people in charge who believe that Sharia law should be the law of the land.
Mm. Well, that's right. And that's a very bad example of how, in a lot of Arab countries particularly, people are given a choice between brutal secular dictatorships or these bearded mullahs. I think interfering, as we did, backing the coup attempt, fulfilled all of the conspiracy theories of the maddest Islamists. It allowed them to say, you see, they talk about freedom and democracy, but actually they'll never let us get our own way. I think we made a real mistake by backing the coup in Egypt. I think we would have done much better to say Egyptians are the main victims of Morsi's incompetence. They will vote him out. You know, they've got more incentive than anyone has. And I put this point to one of the generals, and he said, but he had 2 more years to go. You know, were we supposed to just sit there and leave him for all that time? And I said, yes, that's the idea. You know, like we had to wait for Gordon Brown, like the cousins are having to wait for Obama. That's the idea.
And we feel the same way. 2 more years of this, can we really survive it? I'm speaking with Daniel Hannan, who's the author most recently. The book in the United States will be called Inventing Freedom, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World. Are we at war with Islam, and should the Western world be at war with a group that aspires to create a Middle East-wide caliphate?
Well, those are two really very different questions, and I think it's critical to understand the difference. In every mosque in my constituency, you will have denunciations every Friday of these lunatics in Syria and Iraq and the evil that they're doing. I mean, a friend of mine who's actually a conservative politician summarized it very neatly. He said, you know, as a Brit, I am horrified, disgusted by the thought of what these people are doing. But as a Muslim, I console myself with the knowledge that they're going to hell.
I'm speaking with Daniel Hannan, who's the author most recently of a book you'll find in America, under the title Inventing Freedom, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. Daniel Hannan is my guest, the author of How We Invented Freedom, if you buy the British edition, or Inventing Freedom, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World, if you buy the United States or Canadian edition of that book. Before we leave this all together, we hear stories from Great Britain and from the United States, Dearborn, Michigan, of Muslim peoples who have set up communities in America. They're enjoying the American dream. Buy a house, put your kids in public school, save the money to put them into college or university. And then we hear that there are communities that say, we don't really want to be governed by U.S. laws. We want to have Sharia law. And it kind of creeps in. And I'm wondering if that, I see that as a corrupting influence, because it's saying we don't want to go with the laws that you mentioned are the bedrock of having any kind of functioning democratic society. We want to have our own laws, and our own laws are dramatically different. They assume that women are second-class people, that their testimony in court is not worth as much, that their rape must be witnessed by four Muslim men for it to be a legitimate charge of rape, that if you're a homosexual, you should die, that if you reject the prophet or reject Islam, then you should die. There are a number of things you can die for in Islam, and those laws are actually carried out in some countries. Afghanistan was one. Right after they, you know, right after the United States booted the Taliban, the new Afghani government said, this man has left Islam, we're going to execute him for it. That, I think, I say, is incompatible with the kind of pluralistic society that you have and that we have. Am I wrong?
Question. Absolutely no question. Citizenship is a two-way street, and it depend on civil values. But I have to say, I represent the southeast of England. I have a large region, some 6 million constituents, of whom probably about 180,000 are Kashmiri Muslims, and, you know, who are active in all political parties and have the same kind of concerns that anyone else has about healthcare, education, etc. Hand on heart, in the 15 years that I've been representing that area, I have never heard a single constituent saying, yeah, you know, maybe we could do with a little bit more of a Sharia-type legal system. Yeah, you know, maybe the Iranians have got the right. I've just never heard that. On the contrary, what I hear over and over again is, thank God we're living in this country. There is no better place to live as a Muslim because I can practice my faith openly without any religious zealots telling me what to do. And it's just important to get the fact that you were talking about, you know, the Christians who condemn the madman who attacked
abortion bomber
clinics. Yeah. Right, quite. I mean, there was a religious edict by the Council of Imams in Britain, a fatwa, actually, to use the correct word for it, against ISIL or Islamic State or whatever we want to call them, saying the first loyalty of every British Muslim is to the United Kingdom. You know, it doesn't maybe get the same coverage on your side of the Atlantic, but the problem we have is that the people who are tempted to take up arms for these criminals, the last people they're listening to are the mainstream Muslims. They regard them not as fellow Muslims at all, but as kind of traitors and collaborators. So saying mainstream Muslims have to say more is kind of missing the target. They are every Friday up and down the country in their mosques saying, you know, what the Islamic State people are doing is diabolical. But they're the last people that the jihadis listen to. I think we need to get tough in security and legal terms with how we track them, how we find out what they, how we find them before they get radicalized. And if we miss the opportunity to do that, then we remove their citizenship and they cease to be British nationals.
There's quite a controversy. I know you say that differently, but a controversy in Rotherham with the abuse of young girls. And it seems to all come back to a particular community, but it's almost as though the media is afraid to say which community it comes back to. So they use oblique terms that you kind of have to read between the lines to figure out who they're referring to. And that's the concern I have when we become afraid to say this is a problem, whatever the problem happens to be. And it seems to center around a particular community of people who are followers of a particular religion. Should we be concerned about that?
Well, what you say is true in every respect except one. It wasn't the media who were afraid to make that link. It was the leftist local authority. And you find that in some of these Labour rotten boroughs, these one-party states in the north of England, you have these far-left local officials who are trapped in a kind of early 80s politically correct time warp where everything is seen through the prism of race. And therefore, you have to carry out the most extraordinary contortions in order, as in this case, to avoid identifying a pattern of abuse with, you know, monstrous consequences. But if you look at the reaction across the whole country to that case, I mean, not least from Pakistani communities, they have reacted, if anything, with louder and, you know, more extreme disgust than anybody else because they feel, kind of personally offended by it. So I think what we're talking about here is an ideology that has taken root in parts of the public sector that has been repeatedly disowned now by successive prime ministers, but it is very, very hard to weed out in places where it's ingrained.
Daniel Hannan is my guest. His book in Great Britain is called How We Invented Freedom. In the United States and Canada, Inventing Freedom, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World. So how do we go about spreading these ideas to make the modern world spread to more of the world, more of the globe, where it seems to be, well, absent from big parts of Africa, big parts of Asia, big parts of the former Soviet Union? How do we get those freedoms to take hold in other places?
I think that's a really good question, and I think it comes down to self-confidence. And I'd give the same answer in terms of how do we defeat the terrorists in Syria and Iraq. You know, I was talking to a Polish friend of mine, an MEP, who is my kind of age, and he was telling me about the impact on him as a teenager of John Paul II's visit to Poland as the first ever Polish pope. Mm-hmm. And he told me something that I'd never heard before that was fascinating. He said, you know what? The pope never directly criticized the communist authorities. Mm. He said, you know, he didn't need to. He just offered something better. And I think that is a great lesson for conservatives, right? We sometimes make the mistake of moaning about all the things we don't like. And heaven knows there are lots of things not to like. You know, our treasuries are being emptied, our credit exhausted, our children are laden with debt, our patriotism is scorned. It's so easy to be cross, to be curmudgeonly, but we cease to be persuasive if we lose that optimism, that breath of warmth, that sense of a better tomorrow that Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher had, the belief that we are offering a better future. I think that's the most important thing. Now, I cannot think of a more rotten, bankrupt, meager ideology than the one espoused by these Salafi madmen in Syria. And I cannot think of a better, fuller, freer one than Anglo-Saxon liberalism. Right? Well, against the 500 madmen who have gone off to fight them, look at the millions queuing up to get into your country and mine. We have a good system. Instead of going around, as your president does, apologizing for it, we should be proud of what we've achieved.
Daniel Hannan is the author of How We Invented Freedom. You should read it. He is a British politician, journalist, and an author who's also a member of the European Parliament representing Southeast England for the Conservative Party. Daniel, it is always a pleasure to have you on the program. You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you, Lars.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and we'll get back to your phone calls a little bit later at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. It is a real pleasure to welcome to the program the chair of the History Department at Western Connecticut State University. He's a lawyer. He's also a PhD. He's also the author of four other books, but his most recent is Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary, A Radical Struggle to Remake America. Professor Gutzman, thank you very much for taking the time.
I'm very happy to be here, Lars.
So why do you call him a radical?
Well, because his program for remaking Virginia and America into a Republican society was radical. So I'll give you two illustrations of that fact. First, a very fine historian named Holly Brewer discovered about 20 years ago and published in an academic history journal that when the revolution started, about two-thirds of the land in today's Virginia belonged to about 85 families. In other words, each of those families owned about, on average, 300 square miles of Virginia. That, in my little state of Connecticut, means half of one of the eight counties was owned by each of these families. And Jefferson thought, well, this obviously is not conducive to Republican government. It might be consistent with having a monarchy, but it's not consistent with Republican government. And the reason why these concentrated landholdings were living on generation after generation is that they had feudal land tenures, primogeniture, which said that the oldest son inherited the estate, and entail, which meant that even if you were the current holder of one of these gigantic landed estates, you could not alienate any of it. That is, if you inherited it, you couldn't sell any of it. And so Jefferson in 1776 proposed that Virginia's legislature, newly independent, abolish primogeniture and entail, which it did. And by the time Jefferson died, these landholdings had all been broken up. So the old landed aristocracy in Virginia no longer existed. That, I put to you, was a radical reform. Another very important radical reform, and this is one that we actually usually associate with Jefferson, was disestablishing the colonial church, which was the Church of England. Of course, Virginians, when they declared independence, weren't realizing that that was going to entail a lot of other reforms too. So, for example, they didn't realize, well, we have this state church, and the head of it is the King of England. So if we're going to declare independence from the King of England, we're going to have to reconsider having him be the head of our church. Jefferson thought that, as he put it in the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, God hath made the mind of man free, and so government should not be telling you what religion to subscribe to, what religious practices to engage in, which ministers you had to pay, and so on. And so he wrote that statute that made Virginia the first officially secular society in the history of the world, and that was passed in 1786 through the legislative efforts of his best friend and closest ally, James Madison. There are several other things that Jefferson did that were radical as well, but I think even if the only things he had ever accomplished were abolishing primogeniture and entail and writing the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, he'd still be one of the most important politicians in American history.
But you can see where the ideas that are now just part of our Constitution have been written into the founding document of the country came from this architect of the Constitution and his good friend from up the road in Charlottesville, James Madison. This is where they grew out of, actual practice by Jefferson.
Well, yes, Jefferson, although he wasn't involved in writing the Constitution, was one of the chief kind of apostles of the Constitution. So he knew firsthand people who were very prominent in making the Constitution, and he was one of the people who popularized some of the leading principles of the Constitution. His underlying principle, whenever it came to questions of constitutionalism, was what we now call federalism. So he first came to continental attention in 1774 when he wrote a pamphlet that came to be called A Summary View of the Rights of British America. And in that pamphlet, he argued that within the British Empire, local legislative authority was in the provincial legislatures. So Parliament wasn't the world legislature of every place that was part of the British Empire. Instead, it was just the local legislature of Great Britain. And similarly, Virginia's, Massachusetts, the Bahamas, Hanover's local legislatures should be allowed to legislate for them unless it had to do with foreign policy. This was going to be the position that he took, of course, in the Declaration of Independence. He kept the same position when it came to the Articles of Confederation, and even under the U.S. Constitution, he at one point referred to the federal government as, quote, our foreign government. And the reason that he used that terminology is because he always thought of his country, and whenever he used the phrase my country, he meant Virginia was his country. So this federal principle, the idea of radical decentralism in the political system, that for him was extremely significant, and of course it was also highly radical.
My guest is Professor Kevin Gutzman, who's the author most recently of Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary. Let's talk about federalism, because what would Jefferson make of today's reach from the federal government? I would call it overreach by the federal government into virtually every aspect of our lives, no matter which one of the states that we live in.
Oh, well, actually, my first book was called The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution. And what it is a Jeffersonian history of American constitutionalism. Essentially, at every major juncture, we have taken the anti-Jeffersonian turn since the 1850s. So the fact that today we have courts that make most of our significant social decisions for us, the fact that the president has essentially untrammeled power to make war without involving Congress, the fact that Congress is allowed by the judiciary and feels itself entitled to spend money on anything it wants, these are all anti-Jeffersonian tendencies in our government. I'm sure that Jefferson would find this appalling, because it has the effects that he anticipated and wanted to avoid. One is, of course, that you can't really affect your government unless you're wealthy or famous or you're one of the very few people in America who hold the high federal offices and so on. And for Jefferson, government ought to be decentralized, because if you favored the state government against the federal government, and then if you favored local government against the state government, you had average people in their own towns able to make decisions about their own lives. And of course, in our system, it doesn't really matter what the people vote for. In the end, we know that likely Congress or a federal court will make a decision. Those people, you don't have any control over them at all. So this is an un-Republican tendency in our government, and as I say, it's an anti-Jeffersonian tendency.
Well, for example, marriage, I'm sure, was at least as important and perhaps even more important then than today's society views it, and yet we had 30 states that voted no on a gay marriage change, and then we had the federal government through the Supreme Court simply say, nope, we're going to impose it nationwide. That wouldn't have been an idea that pleased President Jefferson, would it?
No, and actually I was able to predict about 20 years ago when I first noticed that faculty members at elite law schools were starting to favor the idea of gay marriage. I predicted that ultimately we'd have a federal court telling us that the Constitution required this. And the reason I could predict that is because that's what federal courts do. They tell us that the Constitution requires generally the policies that faculty members at elite law schools want. And of course, if you notice, nowadays the Supreme Court is made up entirely of graduates of Harvard Law School and Yale Law School with a pending nomination of another guy from Harvard Law School. So in general, very, very narrow range of opinion is reflected on the Supreme Court. This wouldn't be a problem if the court just acted as a court, but since it's our supreme legislative body, since it makes all the interesting policy choices for us, this is, I think, a severe difficulty.
I'm talking to Professor Kevin Goodsman, who's the author most recently of Thomas Jefferson, Revolutionary. We'll continue this in a moment, and you can send your emails to me, talk@LarsLarson.com, and we'll have a link to the professor's book up at LarsLarson.com in case you missed the title or missed his name. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to be talking to Professor Kevin Goodsman, who is at Western State Connecticut. I goofed that up. Western Connecticut State University. I reversed it. And on the faculty member of LibertyClassroom.com, he is the author of four other books, and the most recent is Thomas Jefferson, Revolutionary, A Radical Struggle to Remake America. In the book, you talk about Jefferson's kind of curious approach to slavery and the rights of black Americans, because I think people would assume, well, we know that he favored ending slavery, but he saw, and you write in the book how he assumed that American Indians would be assimilated into our culture of this new country, but that black former slaves, when they became former slaves, would not. How did that work out? How did he come to that conclusion?
Well, Jefferson, as you say, was occupied and sometimes preoccupied with this question of slavery from very early in his political career. One of the first experiences he had as a member of the House of Burgesses in his 20s, in the 1760s, well before independence, was of co-sponsoring a bill that ultimately would have meant the end of slavery in Virginia. And he co-sponsored it with a cousin of his, Richard Bland, who was a senior member of the legislature. And as he explained what happened, Jefferson said he sat there and listened as basically every other member of the House excoriated Bland. They called him an enemy to his country. He said he had never heard such harsh language used about so venerable a member on any other occasion. And at that point, he realized that white Virginians were not ready for the idea of getting rid of slavery. And so he continued to think about it. However, in his one book, Notes on the State of Virginia, which he wrote in 1781, Jefferson said, well, of course, blacks are entitled to self-government, but he said, the whites are strongly prejudiced against them. And Jefferson said, we, meaning the white Virginians of his day, give them new reason every day. So he said he thought it impossible that slaves could be freed in Virginia without there being a terrible race war. He thought the animosity would continue indefinitely, and so he said that the solution to this is for the blacks to have self-government somewhere else. And this was not just rhetorical. Sometimes people say, well, you know, those founding fathers, especially Jefferson, they were hypocrites because they said all men were created equal, but then they owned slaves. But Jefferson didn't just say that blacks were entitled to self-government and that some other place should be found in Virginia for them to be free. In fact, he worked on this problem through his entire career. He, at various points, contacted foreign governments. He contacted the British government about having black people from America sent to Sierra Leone, which is a new anti-slavery colony founded by the British in West Africa. He asked other people in federal politics about sending blacks from Virginia to the Midwest. He inquired about having them go to Canada. At some points, he speculated about the idea that, well, maybe, although we are very averse to the way the Haitian government has come to be independent and run by black people, the people in Haiti would think that the people we consider to be villains for participating in slave uprisings are heroes. Maybe we could send them there. And finally, at the end of his life, his one-time political lieutenant and former law student, James Monroe, who of course was the fifth president of the United States, was president and was a sponsor of founding of the West African country of Liberia, whose purpose was to be, as Jefferson at one point put it, a receptacle for the blacks from America. So the first settlers in Liberia were former slaves and free blacks from the United States. That was what Jefferson expected and hoped would happen.
But he also imagined that there could be a construction where America would have had separate communities of black Americans within states, and that they would be self-governing, but it would almost create a state within a state, much, I guess, like the Indian reservations have become sovereign nations within a sovereign nation?
Well, not within a state. So
He wanted them physically to be moved somewhere else so that they would have full rights, but not here.
Yes, well, by here, at some points he's thinking of Virginia, and at other points he's thinking of the United States. Freed people from Virginia and other southern states could be sent. The problem then, he said, was, well, I'm not sure that Kentuckians would want to have Michigan be composed of former slaves and be so close by. So ultimately he lit on the idea that, well, it has to be outside the United States. But again, the point is, of course, this all sounds very bizarre to us because we're
using
this idea of a biracial society and so on. But Jefferson's expectation was that whites would vehemently oppose the idea of freeing slaves and leaving them in the country. And if this sounds absurd, well, you have to recognize that from the 13th Amendment to the Voting Rights Act was 100 years, and the situation in which black people survived in America was very difficult. Kind of like what Jefferson predicted. There never came to be the race war he feared, but there was a hideously bad system of subjugation of black people from 1781 to 1865 with the end of slavery, which of course white Virginians didn't agree to, and then from 1865 with the formal end of slavery by the 13th Amendment to 1965 when black people actually were going to have the right to vote and become real American citizens. So Jefferson thought all these difficulties were, or this kind of difficulty at least, was predictable and could be avoided by this colonization notion. So the point of the chapter in the book is that while some of Jefferson's thinking seems completely foreign and kind of repellent to us, what it represents is him working out the radical notion that Americans ought to be free and equal, and that besides Americans, the slaves ought to be free and equal, too.
It is. You're right about that. I'm talking to Professor Kevin Gutzman, who's the author most recently of Thomas Jefferson, a Revolutionary. If you could pick one of his radical ideas from then and apply it today, are there any that are applicable to some of our current troubles in this country?
Oh, well, I think everything I've just been talking about.
Well, yeah, I agree.
But another one is, of course, he said, if he could have one amendment to the Constitution, it would be this, that the federal government can't borrow money.
Oh, what a revolutionary idea. And imagine how much better we'd be. Well, we'd be at least $20 trillion better off.
I think that would make a great change in our system. That would make a great change in our prospects. I, for one, worry whenever I think of it, about the fiscal plight of the federal government, which I anticipate getting much worse before it gets any better.
Professor, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I hope we can call on you from time to time to come on the show and talk about current events as well. But congratulations on Thomas Jefferson, Revolutionary, and thanks so much for the time.
I was happy to do it.
Professor Kevin Gutzman, A Radical Struggle to Remake America is his book about Jefferson. We're glad to have had him with us. Emails, go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can follow on Facebook at The Lars Larson Show and on Twitter at Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And a lot of attention is being paid to the idea of decriminalizing heroin. Oregon has done it. Other states are considering it. Heck, there are cities that are setting up shooting galleries where people can shoot heroin in a safe place with a clean needle. Well, Inga Fricklin joins me now, who's a former assistant state prosecutor in Chicago, policy advisor to Afghanistan, and Law Enforcement Action Partnership, LEAP, board member. Ms. Fricklin, thank you very much for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much for asking me.
Is it a good idea to decriminalize or defelonize the use or possession of heroin?
The new statute under this House Bill 2355 really has not decriminalized it, but it has defelonized it.
Yeah, that's what I said.
And yes, I think it's an excellent idea. It's a step in the right direction.
Why?
Because so many of the problems that we have, especially with drugs like heroin, cocaine, meth, are because of the fact that it's illegal.
Well, you just made the point. You just made the point, though. This does not make it legal. It still will be a misdemeanor to sell it, to buy it, to possess it, to use it. So it doesn't make it legal, as alcohol was finally made legal by the change
right.
in the Constitution.
So I say it's a step in the right direction, but it's not all the way there yet. But it's certainly an improvement for people to end up with a misdemeanor conviction rather than a felony conviction. That's an important step.
Well, tell me this then. Your ultimate goal then would be to see heroin legalized in America?
Yes.
As a recreational drug?
No on that. Now, for marijuana, which is now quite legal in Oregon, yeah, I think there's some real recreational potential, just as there is for our craft beer. But the word legalization, I wish we had another word to use because it sounds so much like seal of approval. And I really can't think of any good reasons for using heroin. People fall into it, and this is very unfortunate.
Well, it's a destructive drug. How would legalization make society better if, as you say, the ultimate goal is to make it legal? How would American society be if people knew that they could use heroin, and I can't think of another reason to use it other than recreationally, so that people can get high? What would America look like if people could simply use heroin anytime they want and be high anytime they want? And I assume then at some point you'd have to both produce the poppies, produce the drug, and sell it through some kind of legal mechanism. How would that make us all better off?
Because the deaths that are occurring right now are largely because of the adulterants that go into heroin, things like fentanyl. Now, take an example of Switzerland, which ever since 1994, it has been legal for any self-described heroin addict to go to a government clinic, shoot up with heroin supplied by the clinic. Now, we're not talking just about clean needles, but actually pure heroin. There hasn't been a death, in contrast to what we've got in this country. They find HIV transmission is down, hepatitis transmission is down, crime is way down. And essentially what's being done there is putting people on heroin maintenance if they are unable to get off it. And then some people will try to get off it, and treatment is readily available. And it's also become much less attractive to young people, because a government clinic with pure stuff has competed with the shooting galleries, which were social recruitment sites.
But aren't these people going to be chasing a high then the whole time that they're addicted, and their addiction is not going to go away?
That's entirely possible. But, we keep people on maintenance for cholesterol, for high blood pressure.
But Ms. Fricklin, nobody wants to have high cholesterol, and you don't get enjoyment out of high cholesterol. But as I understand it, people get a lot of enjoyment out of getting high on heroin, and that as they develop a tolerance, they may want a larger and larger dose so they can get a better and better high. And it sounds like that's a road toward somebody eventually overdosing or simply becoming incapacitated by the drug. And when they can't work anymore, when they can't be productive anymore, who's going to support them and who's going to support their drug habit? Because right now, many of them support their drug habit either by selling drugs or by stealing from people.
Sure. And that's why the Switzerland experiment is so interesting to look at. They are finding that people are managing to get themselves off because treatment is offered, which is very hard to come by in this country, by getting a maintenance dose at a clinic. And they know that it's not going to be adulterated with fentanyl or something deadly. You know, we use the word overdose of heroin in this country, but there aren't that many people dying of pure heroin. It's the additives that are killing them.
The additives that they add to get a greater high.
No, it's what's added by the criminals who are selling the stuff, because if they cut the product, they can keep their profits up and they don't care who dies. You know, during prohibition of alcohol, literally hundreds of Americans died of poisoned alcohol because the criminal market, the sellers, they really don't care. So part of what a move toward legalization, which would permit regulation, is that it's taking the market away from the criminal element.
Unless people decide to continue to obtain it illegally, which you mentioned the legalization of pot in Colorado, in Washington, and Oregon, there's still an illegal marketplace for those drugs, even though they're sold legally at state-authorized stores. So why would there not also be an additional market? In fact, I'm aware from the police that people who are on methadone will often take their methadone dose and then go out and chase some heroin as well because they believe that they want to get high. They don't just want to be maintained.
Yeah. Well, there's really no perfect solution to something which happens to be widely available on this planet. And human beings, for whatever reason, you know, are susceptible to things that will get them high. You know, if there is any product on the planet, whether it's grain, fruit, cocoa leaves, marijuana, opium poppy, if there's anything that can be distilled, smoked, in order to produce a high, human beings have tried it. They just seem to be built that way.
Ms. Frickland, is there any value at all to what is currently done now? When you say treatment is hard to get, it's paid for by Medicaid right now, and treatment is available. So if somebody is told you've been caught, you may be facing down the barrel of a felony, but if you'll go into treatment, we'll forgive the felony and you won't end up with a record at all, and people go into treatment in many cases, and some of them stick with it. You want them to simply not have that incentive anymore, because the law won't have any way to say we want you to get treatment, because the legal system will have said it's okay for you to stay high for the rest of your life if you choose to.
But why is it that we insist that someone not get high?
Ms. Frickland, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. I can't agree with you, but I appreciate your time.
Well, I'm certainly happy to talk about it. And remember, legalization does not mean anything goes.
Inger Frickland, who is a former assistant state prosecutor in Chicago, you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get back to your phone call shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. But I want to talk about a cyber stalking law in the state of Washington, which makes it illegal for you to effectively say mean things about someone. Now, I'll differentiate between things you say that are threatening, like I'm going to beat you up, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to hurt you or your family, and things that are just critical of someone else. Apparently, there are some in law enforcement and maybe even in the DA's offices who believe that you can prosecute someone for merely saying things that are critical of someone else. There's a case just like that involving Richard Lee Reinerson, who has now filed a lawsuit against the Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson and the Kitsap County Prosecutor Tina Robinson, filed suit in U.S. Circuit District Court on Tuesday. And one of the lawyers who's going to bat for Mr. Reinerson is an old friend of the program, and that is Professor Eugene Volokh, the law professor at UCLA School of Law. Professor Volokh, good to have you on the program.
Oh, good to be on.
Let me have you react, first of all, to the idea that there is a cyber stalking law that makes it illegal to say mean things. Can that possibly be constitutional?
No, it can't. That's my view as a lawyer here, but it's also something I've long argued as an academic. Washington statute in particular bans online speech that's said repeatedly or anonymously. If a jury finds that the speaker's purpose is to, quote, harass, intimidate, torment, or embarrass. So if you say something twice online with the intent to embarrass someone, then you're committing a crime. Likewise, if you are intending to torment, there's no definition of torment, but presumably it's if you're intending to say things that make the other person feel bad, or intending to harass. Harass itself is not well defined, but basically, if you look at how it's been defined elsewhere, like the dictionary definition, for example, says to vex, trouble, or annoy continually or chronically. So if somebody posts things that repeatedly annoy and are intended to annoy their subject, again, could be a government official or could be a local activist. That's a crime. That cannot be correct. I think it's clearly unconstitutional.
I'm talking to Eugene Volokh, who's a law professor. He also publishes the blog The Volokh Conspiracy and is the author of several textbooks, most recently The First Amendment and Related Statutes. Professor, I have a confession for you, because it sounds as though I do this on a daily basis. I mean, I go on the air, and our radio show is broadcast on radio stations, but it's also carried online. So online, I regularly and routinely say things that I'm sure would be vexing to Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, various governors and right. senators and everything else.
That's right. All I should say, it is the law is limited to speech that is intended to embarrass.
Well, I intend to embarrass politicians on a regular basis.
There you go. And I think some people deserve to be embarrassed. And journalists do that all the time. By the way, I'm also challenging, also pro bono, an Ohio law that actually is a little different from the Washington law. One of the ways is it has a specific exclusion for the media. So you and I would probably be immune for things we post online in our publications. Ordinary people who aren't employed by a newspaper or a radio station or a list of other such media, well, nope. They don't get the special privilege of being able to speak about people with the intent to supposedly harass them.
Professor, I find that one offensive because I've always pointed out to people, as a journalist, I don't have any more rights or fewer rights than a general member of the public. I mean, I have a microphone, but I don't have any extra rights.
You shouldn't have extra rights, generally speaking, and the First Amendment does not give you any extra rights. But Ohio law, again, Washington doesn't fall into this problem, but Ohio law does decide that, well, you know, journalists should be free to intend to harass people, but not ordinary folk.
So this gentleman we're talking about, Richard Lee Reinerson III, is a man who's been critical of a local activist, a man who founded a memorial to the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, Clarence Moriwaki. And as I understand the controversy, Mr. Reinerson has been critical of Mr. Moriwaki because he says if you're going to object to the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, you should also object to indefinite detention of people in the war on terror in 2017. And I don't necessarily agree with him on the indefinite detention, but I agree with his ability to go out and criticize Mr. Moriwaki. And yet he's been threatened with prosecution. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, that's exactly right. And the prosecutor actually so the police department referred that to the prosecutor, and I believe the police department's view was there was probable cause for the prosecution. The prosecutor decided that he wouldn't prosecute at this point, but said that, well, we might prosecute you if you keep doing this sort of thing. So that shows that there really is a serious threat of prosecution for our particular client, which will help our case go forward procedurally. We're arguing the statute is unconstitutional on its face. So it doesn't just our lawsuit doesn't just focus on the particular thing that Mr. Reinerson said, but in order to have standing to challenge the law, it helps that he has in fact been specifically threatened with prosecution.
I mean, the thing about this is this is such a routine thing to do that if you take issue with a local city council member, a county commissioner, or a governor or a state representative, if I wanted to be critical of Richard Blumenthal, I'd regularly remind people that he lied about serving in Vietnam, and he did lie about serving in Vietnam. Now, it might be that Blumenthal is pushing, you know, keeping Obamacare or whatever, but one of the techniques you might use is to say, remember, this guy who's promising you in this bill that he's going to do good for you, is the same guy who lied to you about Vietnam. If I right. do that on a regular basis, of course I intend to vex him, and of course I intend to embarrass him, but I'm allowed to do that. Right.
Indeed. Well, let me give you an example of how else a nearby provision of the same statute was used a few years ago. In the city of Renton in Washington, this is back in 2011, there were some sex scandals, minor sex scandals in the police department. And somebody started posting YouTube videos, little cartoon videos, which were referring to these sex scandals. There's a nearby provision of the statute which applies not to repeated communications, but to any lewd, lascivious, or indecent or obscene words, images, or language, or suggesting the commission of any lewd or lascivious act with the intent to harass, intimidate, torment, or embarrass. So what happened is the city got a search warrant in order to review records to try to figure out who it was who was posting these things on the theory that these criticisms of the police department were lewd and lascivious.
Professor Volek, it's always a pleasure to have you come on the program. Thank you so very much.
Very much my pleasure. All the best.
Thank you. Law professor from UCLA School of Law. He publishes The Volek Conspiracy, and he's the author most recently of The First Amendment and Related Statutes. He is Professor Eugene Volek, and this is the Lars Larson Show.